You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. Thanks for tuning in to the Free Oromia podcast. Visit our website at freeoromia.org. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Team Free Oromia, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Team Free Oromia. You can also give us a call on the Free Oromia podcast hotline at 430-755-0727 and leave us a voicemail asking us questions or giving us your feedback. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome or welcome back to the Free Oromia podcast, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. I am Jael Ango, and I am joined by my co-host, Jael Maro.
Hey, Jael Ango.
Hey, Jael Maro. I always have to like stop myself from saying Jael Maro when I'm about to say your name. I'm just like, it's Jael Maro.
I remember when I went back home 2 years ago, and everyone was like, Jael Maro, when I would introduce myself and say, oh, I'm Maro too, or you can call me Maro, and they'd just be like, oh, Jael Maro, and I'm like,
okay. You're like, yeah. Okay, yes.
I'll take it, I mean. Yeah. I just don't want to.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, who wouldn't? We are also joined by a return guest co-host, the amazing Jael Urga. Hello, Jael Urga.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Hi. We're very happy to have you again. So excited to have you back. And alongside Jael Urga, we also have...
Drumroll, please.
Yeah, literally.
Can you hear me?
I was doing it too. We have none other than the incredible Jael Lalise. Welcome, Jael Lalise.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. By the way, I did not deserve that, but thank you. I am a massive fan of you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here with us. It's so good to have you. Yeah, very, very excited. So Jael Lalise, that's a really beautiful Jael name, actually. I really like it. Like, how did you pick it? How did you decide on that one?
Thank you so much, Jael Ango. Actually, Jael Lalise is my mum's name that was used when she was part of the Oromo Liberation Front. So before she joined the army, her name was something else that I can't disclose. But after she joined, her first name was changed to Lalise and her surname was changed to Galmo to protect her identity as a civilian. Mm. And also that was the name that she took from then on forward as somebody who was committed to the plight of the Oromo people. And also prior to joining the Qabso, a lot of Oromo people have names that were given to them as a result of religion or colonization. So they have Amara names and so on. When they join the OLF, they are given Oromo names. And my mom's first name wasn't a purely Oromo name. And her surname also wasn't the case. So she was given a fully Oromo name, Lalise, which means bloom. Galmo, which means, I think, Galma. I'm not really sure what Galmo means, but yeah, Galma kind of translates to the same thing.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Wow, that's so beautiful. So Jael Lalise is a real Jael name. It belongs to a real Jael. That's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You win. I love that so much. Did you does your mom know that you use that?
So yeah, I had to call her earlier today to ask for permission. I honestly wasn't gonna use it until I spoke to her. If I was anybody else, I wouldn't use it. But because I am her daughter, I'm also her firstborn. Mm-hmm. I also went through some of the experiences that she lived through. And I was also the first one she told everything about.
Mm.
I kind of feel like, you know, we're kindred spirits. And after asking for her permission, I've honestly always wanted to be Jal Lalise if I ever got to be on this show, because I know how much I've always wanted to be on it. I always thought I would be Jal Lalise, but of course you can't do that without asking permission from the person whose name means so much because of their lived experiences. So yeah, I had to ask her, even though she's my mom, I had to call her and say, hey mom, is it okay? But honestly, she did say yes.
I love that. Mm-hmm. She passed the torch on to you and you're obviously blazing full steam ahead. No, I just mixed up a bunch of different metaphors, but you know what I mean.
She's only half get an what hour you mean. We get what though, you mean. Guys. I was gonna be Jal Biftu, and then I said, oh, I have time to be Jal Lalise. Let me call and inquire about the possibility of being Jal Lalise.
Mm. Nice, nice. Well, very glad that you did, and very honored to have a representative for Jal Lalise here on the show with us.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And could you introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us a little bit about who you are.
So just to give you a bit of an introduction about myself, I am a former refugee. I am now a naturalized British citizen. During my time as a refugee, I spent time in Nairobi, Kenya, for 8 years. And then we were resettled to the United Kingdom by the United Nations.
Yeah, I think... Jal Lalise, it's really good to have you on for this episode, just because of the fact that you have the personal experience with what it's like to be a refugee. I think as Oromos, it's inevitable that we all know so many refugees, because unfortunately this is our story. It's a part of our story. But you know, I think it's different to actually have that experience of having been through it, having been a refugee. And so I'm really glad that you were able to join us today to talk about this topic that I think is on all of our minds right now.
Thank you so much, Jal Marro. It means a great deal to me. Thank you for inviting me and sharing my perspective, and, you know, reflect on my journey as a refugee and also talk about the current situation at hand. Being a refugee is something that definitely stays with you. It's not an experience you forget. Mm-hmm. And it definitely, it takes precedence in molding who you are in your life. And as a result of that, I chose to kind of dedicate my time to, and my life and my work to advocacy. That's why I read law at university. And I'm aspiring to be a lawyer and work in, you know, the government in one way or the other.
That's great.
Yeah, definitely. So in today's episode, we'll be exploring stories and perspectives on the experiences of Oromo migrants and refugees escaping Ethiopia. Oromos have been fleeing Ethiopia for many decades to escape political persecution and violence, as well as debilitating poverty and economic exploitation. So as most of you will probably be aware, a few days ago, on the 7th of March, we heard the gut-wrenching story of scores of Oromo people that had fled Ethiopia and had ended up in a migrant detention facility in Sana'a, Yemen, being intentionally burned alive. There were graphic videos shared of the aftermath that have been spread virally on social media, showing burned bodies of Oromo men, women, and youth. And you can also hear and see witnesses crying and grieving in Afan Oromo. It's extremely traumatic to watch. And one can only imagine how traumatic it is to experience. Oromo people around the world are shocked and mourning, and we'll be talking about this devastating tragedy today, and how it's part of a vicious pattern of the dehumanizing treatment that Oromo refugees and migrants face. Before we get into this episode, though, as usual, please do follow us on our social media, on Instagram and Twitter. You can find us on Team Free Oromia. And do also visit our website, freeoromia.org, and take the Free Oromia survey. So I guess let's start off by talking about what happened in Yemen. To give an overview of the incident, there are reports that say that detained Oromo migrants and refugees in Sana'a, the capital city of Yemen, were crammed in overcrowded prisons, or migrant detention facilities, as they're called, but they are essentially prisons. And they were engaging in a hunger strike to call attention to their poor living conditions in those prisons. So there were over an estimated 900 prisoners in the detention facility. And witnesses say that on the 7th of March, Houthi rebels fired a smoke bomb into the prison, and that ignited a fire which spread very quickly, causing people who were detained in the facility to be burned alive. There isn't a specific number in terms of the death toll, but it's believed to be in the hundreds. A Yemen-based journalist, Nabil Al-Bukhari, says that it could have been up to 450 prisoners who were burned alive. And there is chilling video evidence of the burned remains of the murdered Oromo men, women and youth. And, you know, you just need to open up your Twitter, and that video is circulating everywhere. So how are you guys feeling about this? What's this tragedy causing you to feel?
I'm just completely heartbroken personally. I mean, as a former refugee, as somebody that's been through, you know, a similar experience, but no way near as bad, I am angry that nobody is speaking up about this properly or adequately. I am shocked. But I also just feel sadly quite hopeless, because these people are fleeing from the government of Ethiopia and then running into the hands of smugglers, areas that are torn by war. And they're just really vulnerable with no help, and nobody seems to really care, actually.
Yeah, I agree. It's so devastating. And what's even more compounding is the fact that a lot of the stories of these refugees, many names which we will probably never know, go untold. And that's just as heartbreaking as obviously what has happened. It's just so dehumanizing. It's devastating. The loss is devastating, but also just the lack of, you know, like attention on what's actually happened and the experiences of each soul that has been impacted is, you know, it's really dehumanizing, and that's really difficult to sort of see, you know. Yeah.
Definitely, Urge, it is dehumanizing for somebody that's gone through the sort of experience of being a refugee. I mean, I've never had to deal with being in a fire or, you know, kind of deal with the situation or the circumstances that Oromo refugees in Yemen are having to deal with. Nobody spoke up for us whilst we were living in the situation we were living in as refugees. But thinking that even if it got worse, still nobody would say anything about it, that's very disheartening.
No, I agree with both of you ladies. And I think for the past months, especially, we've been so consumed with all of the tragedies happening back home in Oromia, like to people on the ground, and seeing the way that Kare and Kero are risking their lives to advocate for their freedom, and seeing the other side of things, where even those who say, you know, I'm going to try to escape because I feel like there is no hope for me in this country that doesn't value me at all, that there's no opportunity for me, there's no value of my life, there's no human rights here. And they set out on this journey. Many of them die along the way. And even those who make it to their one of their stops along the way, for this to happen at that point, it just hits you from a completely different angle. Like, our people are not safe at home, and they're not safe when they leave. Mm-hmm. So only, you know, a few people who are lucky enough to find a path that's a little bit more secure or a different way out are able to be safe. But other than that, you're locked in on every side, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the 1951 Refugee Convention actually defines a refugee as someone that is unable to return to their country of origin owing to a well-founded fear, and that can be based on nationality, you know, membership of a political opinion, religion, or whatever it might be. And so when you say people are trapped, that's exactly what it is. Like, even prior to trying to seek asylum somewhere else, you know, many of the people that have lost their lives have already experienced torture, persecution, have been disconnected from family, have experienced significant trauma, like forced separation from family members. And it's just compounding experiences of grief and loss. And then to go somewhere in the hopes that you will have a better future and you will have safety as just being the most basic thing, and then experiencing this level of violence and instability and loss now, it's really heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
No, definitely, Jal Urga, that resonates so much with me, the trauma that you deal with. I mean, I can only speak from my experience. And again, I want to emphasize that my journey as a refugee was no way near as traumatic as what some refugees have been subjected to. It was nowhere near as bad as the people that are currently in Yemen, what they've had to go through, or the Oromo refugees that go through the Mediterranean Sea, all of that. But still, I am still deeply affected by the experiences I've had as a refugee. And you're right, there are so many hurdles that you deal with, and it never pays off, it seems like, especially for these migrants. They have to cross through Djibouti. Many of them die on the way to Yemen. Most of them want to get to Saudi Arabia, but before they even make it to Yemen, they die. And many of them again die and are treated horribly, you know, even set on fire, as we're seeing in Yemen. And then the fortunate few will make it to Saudi Arabia, where they're then again subject to being under the sort of guardianship system. They're pretty much a slave to someone. So it's never easy. It really is never easy. It just seems to be a never-ending set of hurdles they have to jump through.
Yeah.
They get extorted for money on the way to Saudi Arabia all the time. Different border checks. Everyone knows how vulnerable these migrants are as well. They know their Oromo as well. And they really do exploit that because they know why they're leaving home. They know they are hopeless. There's nothing left for them at home, and that they will do anything to try and secure a better life.
Yeah, it's really true. I know last year there was this France 24 video that was released, and I think we all saw that last year. And one of the scenes that just really was disturbing to me was, you know, when they finally made it across the water and they were in Yemen and kind of like getting ready to get out of the little boat that they were in, they were, I don't even know what that person could be called or how to refer to them. Okay, a smuggler.
The smugglers, yeah.
Okay, one of the smugglers, on the, I guess, receiving end was, you know, getting them out of the boats and hitting them, like as if they were just like animals to be herded. You know, they were saying, "Stop hitting us," in Afan Oromo. And it was just so demoralizing to see our people going through that.
It's modern day slavery and exploitation. And, you know, there are people that are benefiting from this. And when people are fleeing persecution at home, oftentimes they don't know what, you know, what the path is going to look like, what their experiences are going to be. So you can just imagine how many of them are just thinking, I didn't know this is what it was going to be like, you know. That's heart-wrenching as well.
Extremely.
No, definitely. That France 24 documentary, you're right, it did come out a year ago, and we kind of just seem to forget about these issues, especially if they kind of came up some time ago. We think, oh, okay, this is old, but it's been an ongoing situation for a long time. And in 2015, Yemen was pretty much in a war. It was a war zone. It started becoming a war zone, but the migration never stopped. It was happening before that. It's happening now, as we can see, obviously, which is why we're here talking about it. So with regards to Aden, where they were getting the people off the boats, Jal Marro, that's a region of Yemen called Aden, and that's near the Red Sea. It's the eastern part of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, I think it's referred to.
Yep.
And so because a lot of these places are not adequately patrolled, monitored, you know, where these migrants could go and say, hey, I seek asylum, if that was a thing. There's no authority, pretty much. It's no man's land, which is why these smugglers have the upper hand. They treat Oromo people whatever way they want to treat them. As they were getting out of the boats in that particular documentary, again, that boat was overloaded. It almost always is, which is why we see news articles all the time, especially when migrants are crossing the Mediterranean Sea. Boat has capsized. They even put them in a rubber dinghy. That's like what you would use in paddling pools, you know, in swimming pools, not to cross the sea, but they do that because they know these migrants are desperate. They will, you know, use any means they can to get away from the sheer horror they face being at home, and their government is the most unhelpful government that could possibly exist. When you have migrant workers in the Middle East, such as, you know, Malaysians and other nationalities, their government speaks up for them and stops this kind of exploitation that that happens as a result of smugglers and human traffickers. But because we have no one, and also a bigger reason is that we have a government that is determined to get rid of us. In fact, I feel like they are complicit in pushing this migration of Oromo people leaving Oromia or Ethiopia and migrating to find a better life, to find jobs.
Yeah, it says a lot that thousands and thousands and thousands of Oromos continuously flee on this path, despite how horrible it has been for people before them. And while I don't think that anyone can fully understand, I mean, even us watching the video, I don't think we can even fully grasp exactly how horrifying it is to go through this journey and the days and days that it takes. But I think for people to continuously risk their lives for this, that just shows you how horrible the conditions are for them and how bleak their future feels for them in Ethiopia. And then speaking to your point, Jalalise, about how the Ethiopian government has absolutely no regard for these refugees, even in the situation that they're facing once they flee. Even the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he just simply referred to it as a fire incident. And it's like you're, you know, as a refugee coming from a government where it's not even, for once, this particular incident wasn't a direct, wasn't directly perpetrated by the Ethiopian regime. It's a very horrible incident that happened to these refugees abroad in another country. And even in that context, they won't speak out for them. They won't advocate for them. They're just simply happy to brush it under the rug.
Yes, and that's just to add to your point, Jalmaro, that they don't care about Oromos. And as a refugee, I've always felt that, honestly. And, you know, as somebody that's genuinely been in that position where they're seeking asylum, they're seeking resettlement for genuine reasons, I've honestly always felt like the Ethiopian government, or whoever the Ethiopian government was at the time when I migrated, or me and my mom left Ethiopia in 2000, it was the TPLF that was in charge, and their reign of terror continued. You know, terror in my eyes as an Oromo, they were responsible for the amputation of my mom's left leg. And it never got better. So the Ethiopian government has never cared about Oromo people. One ounce. And from the perspective of a refugee, it honestly always feels like that. And the fact that you're saying, look at this issue now, what we're dealing with. It, you know, a government that's pretty much engaged in a civil war should speak up about this, because this is one thing that has nothing to do with them. They should say, oh, look what Yemen's doing. You know, under their eyes, migrants who were detained because they are undocumented were burnt alive. But they're not saying any of that because they don't care about Oromo people. They are complicit in this. This is my personal view. I really feel like they push Oromo migrants to leave Oromia because they know that the chances of survival of them making it to Saudi Arabia and then ultimately make it to a Western country somewhere in Europe, which is easier to travel to for them, or, you know, North America, but maybe that's unlikely. They know that there's a very slim chance for those migrants to make it there. So they are not doing anything. The Ethiopian government has never done anything to manage, to police, to just kind of monitor the human trafficking or human smuggling situation in Ethiopia. The Yemeni path is just one path. And in fact, according to that France 24 documentary, Oromo people are well known for taking that path because they are too poor to afford to go on the safer path. There's two paths that the documentary mentions, the long route and the short route. The short route is taken by Oromo people, and it doesn't mean what the name says. It's not a shortcut. It means you have to walk on foot.
No car. Because they can't afford any transportation. Nothing.
Exactly. You have to walk on foot from Ethiopia to Djibouti. Then from Djibouti, you walk for days. Again, the people there are very aware that the Oromo people, they actually refer to them as Oromos, which I was astounded again. You think, oh my God, nobody knows us. You know, we're kind of still in this, engaged in this fight to have our identity known. But yet in this part of the world, they do know us, but for very, very, very wrong reasons. They know us because we are the poorest of the lot. They know the Tigres and the Amaras. And guess what? They travel by vehicle. They would take cars, minibuses, whatever means. And the path that the Oromo people would spend a month maybe walking, they whiz through it by vehicle. And that implies they have enough money to kind of bribe their way through, because this is a very corrupt state.
Yeah, Jad Lalise, thank you for sharing that and for sharing some of your experience. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more for us and for our listeners about your experiences in getting, you said you spent, you know, some years in Nairobi as a refugee, and then you were ultimately resettled to the UK. I was just wondering if you could tell us about more about the experiences that you and your mom had, or you and your family had during that time.
Yeah, so of course I don't mind sharing at all. So we arrived in 2000. Early 2000. I'm not particularly sure what time of the year. I was 4 years old and it was me and my mum. So what drove us to Nairobi was that my mum was a member of the OLF when she was in Oromia. And she was, and that was the case for her from sort of the early 90s until... until about mid-90s, 1995-ish and 1996. That's when she was injured. So she is an above-the-knee amputee on her left leg. And that injury was as a result of a, I think, a bazooka strike.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yes, that's how she sustained that particular injury. And she had me in 1996 in Finfinne. And in 2000, she had to leave because the situation was just getting difficult to manage. For her, she couldn't really do much as somebody that was an active member of the OLF. You know, you can't establish a legitimate business and run it properly, because almost always, you know, you're going to be arrested sometime sooner or later. In fact, there's a funny story where my mom told me we were arrested when I was 40 days old from a district in Finfinne known as Gurji. And the people that came to vouch for her were the neighboring women that lived there. And they said, this woman is has just given birth. Whatever she may have done in her past, whatever you're accusing her of, she's clearly not a danger now, because she is somebody that is disabled and is clearly looking after an infant. What possible danger could she cause? So they vouched for her, and she got out of jail, but she knew she couldn't live in Ethiopia for the rest of her life, because imagine that happening to you with your child at 40 days old.
Yeah.
Right? We still, of course, hear women being arrested in Ethiopia, even though they have infants like Altu Takala. But it's something else to be able to actually experience that yourself. I mean, I'm completely unaware, because I was young, but she kind of went through that. And yeah, so Ethiopia wasn't the place for us to stay and live our life because of who my mom was. There were kind of more eyes on her, you know. I think you can understand, considering now they're arresting opposition political party leaders Before that, they used every excuse they can to, you know, call the OLF a terrorist organization. So this has been happening for a long time. And if you are strongly affiliated with that type of establishment or organization, they're gonna treat you even worse than they would your average Oromo, who already deals with discrimination, harassment, unfair treatment everywhere purely because they are Oromo. But my mom had the added issue of being affiliated with the OLF and being kind of senior in that organization. So she had to leave in 2000 and we left for Kenya. And that was very difficult in the beginning. I actually recount one time, again in the early 2000s, honestly, I don't know what to call this because it happened when I was very young, but hundreds of Oromo people, if not thousands, can attest to this, that lived in Nairobi around the same time I'm kind of alluding to. I was, I kid you not, 5 or 6 at the most when this happened. So this particular incident, as I came to find out about later on, was orchestrated on the Ethiopian government's request. So in early 2000, this could be 2001, 2 or 3, I'm not sure, guys. I was really young, but this is a real life thing that happened. In the area of Nairobi where we lived in, where me and my mom migrated to from Kenya, from Ethiopia, it was known as Isli, and it's an area populated by Ethiopian immigrants and Somali immigrants mostly. Sometime, I don't know what day this was, military police came in and rounded up every Oromo refugee they could find in Isli, in Nairobi. They rounded all of us up. When they came in and knocked on our door, where me and my mum resided at the time, we were sleeping. My mom, somebody who is disabled, had an artificial leg. They came and knocked on our door. Bang, 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 bang. We thought, what on earth is this? What's going on? We didn't open the door in time. So they kicked it in, these military officers. They kicked the door in. They screamed at us. I mean, waking up to this as a child, it was insane to say the least. It was honestly crazy. My mom's terrified. We didn't even speak the language properly at the time. We didn't speak Swahili properly. My mom didn't really understand Swahili properly. And so they're screaming at us in Swahili, like, get dressed, get out, like yelling and shouting at us. And so they whipped us and threw us on the back of a massive truck that was loaded with other Oromo refugees that they had rounded up from the building we lived in, other parts of the district, of the Isli area. When they threw my mom on, because of the way they were beating and hitting us, my mom said to me, she always says this to me, she says, they were hitting us so hard and they were hitting me so hard that at one point I just turned my artificial leg towards them instead of my actual, you know, arm. And my leg that was perfectly okay. She said, I turned the artificial leg towards them, and that artificial leg was made partly from wood. They hit that leg so much that that wood was chipped and damaged and later had to be restored because we didn't have the money. We were refugees fleeing prosecution. Later had to be restored for her, using funds that were raised by the Oromo diaspora in the West.
Wow.
So yeah, even in Kenya, things were that horrible. That happened on two different occasions. That was the first sort of mass roundup they did of Oromo people in the early 2000s. And it was very known amongst the Oromo people that that was at the request of the Ethiopian government at the time. Myself and my mom were in prison, that truck that they loaded us onto, that they threw my mom onto, that they whipped my mom's leg until the wooden part of it was chipped. that truck took us to a prison, and we were in like a square box. There was no roof. There was rooms around that square box that was prison cells. They filled those prison cells up with Oromo people, and in the square they put women and children and old people, as if that showed some sort of care. But yeah, in that small space, people had to urinate, defecate, whatever money they managed to get out with, if they managed to put the coat on and that coat happened to have some change in it, they could bribe a guard to buy them bread. Mm-hmm. And that bread would be shared around. And we were there for 48 hours, myself and my mum. And we were only released after somebody paid off the prison guards, because people in the diaspora were raising money for us. And I was involved in that particular instance, that particular mass imprisonment of innocent people. And there was also one that happened sometime after. Fortunately for me and my family, we were spared from that one. But yes, life as a migrant is, as an immigrant, as a refugee, is hard to say the least, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Leaves you speechless, honestly.
Yeah. It's these lived experiences that help, well, those of us that haven't maybe experienced the refugee journey and the refugee experience truly at least understand, mm-hmm. You know, like what a lot of our brothers and sisters, Oromo refugees go through, and many other refugees as well. And it's really important that we hear these experiences, and like, yeah, it's obviously hard to hear, but it's harder to live. So, you know, I think, you know, what I was saying earlier just about how devastating it is to hear what happened in Yemen, but know that a lot of those people that have lost their lives, like their story and understanding their journey and what they've been through, we may not ever know what that is. And you know, just hearing your lived experience, thank you for sharing it. I'm sure
yes,
you know,
thank you.
I know that you are obviously very open and willing to share your story, but it can't be easy to kind of go back and recall those experiences. And you obviously have a lot of resilience. That's pretty incredible. And I think a lot of listeners will be able to, they'll be able to kind of hear that story, and it might jog their memory about stories their families have told them, their parents may have gone through, uncles and aunties. And, you know, like I think the refugee experience, every single Oromo is either a refugee or has a close family member that has experienced the refugee journey. And that says a great deal about the experiences of the Oromo and just the lack of security, the lack of human rights that exist for Oromos, whether that's back home or whether that's in, you know, countries where you're seeking asylum and trying to, you know, find safety.
No, you're definitely right, Jal Urga, honestly. It takes a lot to be able to share your experience candidly. And I think you have to be, you have to get to a place where you kind of acknowledge that you have gone through this. And as somebody that's lived in the diaspora for a long time now, you can forget, you're right. You completely erase it because it's so traumatic. Again, I haven't been through a fire like the people in Yemen have, like the Oromo people in Yemen have. But I can, I'm still traumatized by the things that I've seen, but it's only the fact that I've acknowledged them. That's what's allowed me to be able to share it with you guys and to honestly reflect on it without painting it differently in my head. I don't know, I guess people might do that, maybe because for me, I went through that as my childhood. And I think people kind of do things psychologically to paint their childhood in a pretty picture, even if it's not meant to be. But I've really kind of, I've had to learn to peel that away. And having the space to be able to do that is an absolute privilege, because I can see what those who don't have that space have to go through. Having the experience of working with asylum seekers that come through the Mediterranean Sea that are mostly Oromos and refugees from the Horn of Africa, I can tell you, I can't imagine the stories they will tell when they get to a place where they'll be able to tell them.
Mm. I think the other thing that kind of, it sort of made me, hearing your story made me think about was, just like the ongoing threat to one's psychological safety as well. And just the also the uncertainty of someone's like refugee status. Because obviously it's, you know, the refugee journey is just that. It's a journey to somewhere where, you know, people have the hopes to have that safety and those rights that they obviously haven't been able to have in their, you know, country of origin in Ethiopia. But that ongoing threat to someone's psychological safety, the ongoing threat of, you know, being detained or sent back, or just like the lack of access to just basic needs, medical needs and income, you know, employment, education, all of those things that, that, you know, people have experienced within Ethiopia in terms of the persecution, but then also experiencing that wherever, you know, they've gone to, seek that, asylum. And, and just, I think now with the current wave of, refugees, the risks around destitution and trafficking and what that means and what role we all have in amplifying the voices of and supporting financially or in other ways our community.
Yeah, you're definitely right, Jalurga. I think, you know, having watched so many documentaries, again, going through the Middle Eastern route or the Mediterranean route is not my personal lived experience, but I've had people tell me about that experience, or I've had the company of being around in the community that have told me what it's like to go through that. And you're right, they are very, very vulnerable to things like human trafficking.
Yeah.
They are. They really are.
And also sexual exploitation, you know, like maybe that's something we haven't really spoken about much today, but certainly is part of the experience of a lot of Oromos as well.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say there is active selling of human beings. You can understand that if they are selling humans, if they are selling people, they are, of course, going to go ahead and exploit women even more because they have the added advantage of, you know, having women work for them in the sex industry, and they could make money that way. Maybe they could do that with men too, but they may be less demand for that. But yes, exploiting women and children sexually or otherwise is definitely a thing. And even when these migrants get to their destination, which is Saudi Arabia, they're still exploited sexually, Jalurga. They really are. The people that employ them there as you know, housekeepers or whatever it may be, just menial labor jobs like that, or even as builders if you're a man. But especially for women, the people that get employment when they ultimately reach their destination, they are still susceptible to being exploited sexually because the people that employ them exploit them.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's really disturbing. I feel like the whole the whole refugee experience, especially in these I mean, so regardless of whether, for example, in this, the documentary we referred to, the France 24 documentary, they were talking mostly about, you know, their economic migrants, because they got, many of them got, for example, kicked out of their homes because they could not pay their rent, and things like that. Or, you know, a young boy saying that he is taking this dangerous journey so that he can get a job, so that he can buy a house, so that his mom can have somewhere to live, you know? And it really ranges. For some people, it's directly political, like you were saying, because of what your, you know, the reason your mom had to flee. And then for some people, it's a range. But the ultimate key here is that they are all of these Oromo refugees are fleeing a dictatorial regime that seeks nothing positive for them, that does not ever value their life. And so, as you were saying, Jalalise, even after leaving, whether it's directly orchestrating some sort of attack from afar through bribing, you know, foreign officials, or, you know, these people controlling the refugee camps, or what, whatever it may be in the particular circumstance, or whether it's, you know, simply ignoring the death of dozens, scores, or even hundreds of people bombed deliberately in Yemen, they have no value for their lives. And so regardless of the specific reason that drove them to say, I'm going to risk my life to take this journey, it all leads back to the regime and the lack of human rights. And it's not an isolated incident. I mean, you see the same thing in Asia, for example. And the, you know, the same thing happens. This is what happens under brutal dictatorships. This is what happens under these brutal regimes. You have people that they can't stay in and they can't stay out. And when, even when they go out, the government seeks to have that control over them. And so they orchestrate these ways for them to be targeted abroad, so that they're hopeless, and so that they cannot live fruitfully outside. And that's why, as many people as we have in the diaspora, imagine if more people were actually able to seek the freedom that they're after, I guarantee you we would be overflowing with an Oromo community abroad.
And you know, for those that are listening and they, you know, may share this with friends or colleagues that are non-Oromo, sometimes there are a lot of like questions around, well, what is it that people actually want? Like, what is sort of the end goal? What are people really like striving for when they embark on what is often known as a really challenging and difficult journey? And in Australia, there's this organization called Foundation House. It's the Victorian Foundation for Survivors of Torture, and they've developed like this leading approach in terms of working towards recovery. And I really like, they've got like these four recovery goals that they talk a lot about, and it's safety and agency, connection and belonging, meaning, identity and justice, dignity and value. And I feel like sometimes that's the language we need to really talk to others about, in terms of, well, why are people going through this journey? It's you know, it's not just this ticket out for a better life, to make, you know, get a job and make money, or to be able to go to a better school. That's often the migrant journey. But the refugee journey is as basic as, I want meaning, I want my identity to be respected, I want dignity, I want value, I want justice. It's And those things, I think, you would hope everyone can understand, or, you know, at least fathom why one might go through such a journey. So I think the like basic wanting safety and agency is something that I think I'm hoping that people can really start talking about their lived experiences or really sharing this with their non-Oromo like friends and community so that we can really amplify the voices of people seeking asylum, Oromos around the world, because there are just probably hundreds of thousands of people all over the world that are right now living this. As we talk and as people listen to this, people are actually living this. And what happened last week in Yemen, as heartbreaking and as devastating as that is, the sad reality is that things like this will continue to happen. So, yeah, I don't know. I hope that those recovery goals also can form some of the language around how we talk about what people are wanting to restore and have in their lives as well.
That's so true. And in my mind, that's how the refugee and migrant experiences and the plight of Oromo migrants and refugees relates back to the Oromo struggle for political and economic self-determination. That's what will allow us to get to a stage where we can start addressing these things that people are seeking when they're fleeing Oromia, when they're fleeing Ethiopia. It all comes back to the fact, all of this is whether people leave for political reasons, whether people leave for economic reasons. It all comes back to the root cause of the colonial exploitation of Oromo people and the colonial oppression and marginalization and persecution of Oromo people. That's what it all ultimately comes back to in the Ethiopian context for Oromo people. So these crises are directly tied to our plight and our struggle for self-determination, for sovereignty, for independence. And achieving those things will allow the Oromo people a space where they don't have to leave their indigenous lands to be able to exist with basic dignity, with basic rights, with basic respect. Like you mentioned, those fundamental things that a human needs to find value in their life and in their existence. So none of these things are separate issues. All of this is just an amalgamation of the challenges faced by the Oromo people due to not having a free Oromia. So it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, truly, for our people on so many levels.
These issues, these plethora of issues that you face as an Oromo, as soon as you leave Oromia and you migrate elsewhere, whether that be Somalia, Djibouti, Kenya, like I went to, wherever you might go to, whatever reason you left for is interlinked with Oromo and Oromia being respected. The sole reason you're hunted down and subject to so many vile treatments as a result of your nationality, pretty much. And I just wanted to say, had Oromia had its independence, my mum wouldn't have left. I know she wouldn't have left. Maybe if things were different in 1991, by 1996, things could have improved for Oromo people by the time she had me. And so for somebody like me who was so invested in the plight of Oromo people and also the fight for Oromia's independence, which is what I truly believe will rid Oromo people of all the issues they experience as a result of who they are.
Good point. That's a very good point.
Can I just say
if listening to this has consciously or unconsciously reminded someone of a past trauma for them, and it's sort of resulted in like re-experiencing a traumatic event or has triggered you in any way, I would just encourage you to speak to someone you trust, or, you know, seek some help. I think it's really important that we encourage that in our community. You know, vicarious trauma is actually a real thing. Hearing these stories, even if you haven't experienced them, can also be challenging, but certainly for anyone that has experienced refugee trauma and has, you know, listened to this episode today and it reminded you of a past trauma, I think it's important for us to just encourage you to speak to someone you trust or speak to someone about that.
No, you're definitely right, Jal Urga. For those of you living in Britain, you can go on, or the United Kingdom, you can go on the Healthy Minds website and fill out a survey and then have an appointment with your GP. I really, really do strongly advise you to address your mental health issues, especially if you're a former refugee or a refugee. I think even if you don't think you're experiencing them, more often than not, we tend to be. So it's better to be safe than sorry. And I obviously, in our community, we need to address mental health better. But do go and seek the appropriate advice.
Thank you very much, both of you, for bringing that up. That is extremely important. So I'm glad that you've both shared that. So to take it back to the horrendous situation in Yemen, the response from the international community so far, international media and humanitarian organisations, does not seem to be even remotely proportional to the magnitude of what's taken place. It's really been rather meager so far. So how do you assess that? What's your take on the response from the international community?
I feel like the international media has contributed to this crisis. And I think, you know, the crowdfunding campaigns, the Twitter campaigns, and just each and every individual with a phone that has social media is essentially able to, share these stories and talk about the experiences of Oromo refugees. Because if this has... this example or this incident is an example of how, you know, identity politics and racism is shaping how the media portray what's happening. And I think as Oromos, we know that the media have never really talked about our experiences through our lens and our experience. So, you know, I feel like there are some tangible, practical things that we can all do to amplify the voices of Oromos, particularly Oromo refugees and people seeking asylum. And I would encourage everyone to just, you know, to use their platform to share these stories.
With regards to the international community, considering what has gone on, honestly, I am shocked, which is why at the beginning, when you asked me how I felt about this, I kind of probably sounded like dumbfounded or bewildered, to be honest, because considering what has gone on, nobody seems to say anything about it. The magnitude of this disaster is huge. The group that's controlling the state is blaming the IOM, which is an agency that acts on behalf of the UN. I went through the IOM as a refugee or as a former refugee. that's one of the ways you they kind of actually take care of the healthcare aspect. So when you are being resettled, they would be the people that would conduct the tuberculosis tests, whatever other tests they may need for you to qualify to come here. And if any of those come back that you have those conditions, you have to stay until you recover from them to come abroad. So the group in charge of the area in Yemen, in Sana'a, is blaming the IOM, and it's saying that they asked the UN to evacuate refugees a long time ago. They've asked the Ethiopian government to do so as well, to get rid of the refugees. But the Ethiopian government obviously doesn't care, as we've established, about Oromos. So they're not going to do any of that. And nobody seems to be taking accountability for something this big is I guess the point I'm trying to make. Like, this involves a group that currently illegally has a hold of Sana'a, and an agency or a subsidiary of the UN, but no one seems to be saying anything about it. I was so confused. I thought this would be big news, but no. I heard the BBC wrote an article about it 5 days or so ago, but no mention of the word Oromo, nothing. It says mostly Ethiopian. The amount of injury and death seems to be unknown because the proper figures aren't being given. And all these things make you think people would be looking into it a little bit more. And you know that Oromo people make up the majority of that number. And the fact that Oromo people are not mentioned in any of these reports, or, you know, the major ones, why are they being left out of this? I'm astounded at the lack of coverage about this very, very, very concerning issue.
So just to clarify, the IOM is the International Organization for Migration. It was one of the first organizations to respond to the incident in Yemen. They claimed that they had personnel present on the ground when it took place. They've also said that they've been blocked from entering healthcare facilities, so they're being prevented from being able to properly deliver medical supplies to people who have been injured and who are in hospitals. They've been responding with some relief effort for the people who were affected by this incident, and the reasons for being blocked from being able to access healthcare facilities is being said to be so that the true death toll won't be revealed, and that the true extent of the devastation won't be seen and understood by the international community. But yes, you're right, the response by the international community has been meek, to describe it mildly, and it is, you know, extremely jarring to see the little reporting that's done not specifically mention their Oromo identity, because them being Oromo is the reason why they have found themselves in this position. The France 24 documentary, and also from the accounts that you've shared, Jala, Lisa, you know, it's common knowledge for people in the region that Oromo people are rife for exploitation because of the exploitation that they're already looking to flee from. So it's really very unfair, and it's a double whammy of not having our struggle and our issues acknowledged. It's a very difficult situation to be dealing with, for sure.
Just to also add to that, the IOM was saying they were waiting for Ethiopia to reopen their voluntary humanitarian return program. But Ethiopia stopped that because of the pandemic, you know, because they're blaming the pandemic for absolutely everything now. So
only
they are
saying... convenient.
Only when it's convenient. True.
For their celebration.
By the way, last time Jal Marro said PP sounds like a pyramid scheme, I laughed. I was like, I can see that happening. I can see the pitch to join the pyramid scheme. I can see the whole thing.
The only difference is people join it by force. The situation.
You're either brainwashed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Or otherwise. But yeah, to get back to the point, IOM stated that there are currently 6,000 refugees that are registered waiting to, you know, be part of this voluntary humanitarian return. If you think about that, who wants to voluntarily return to Ethiopia?
Exactly.
After going through all of that. So there are currently 6,000 people waiting, but the Ethiopian government is still not responding. They're saying, oh, wait until we deal with the pandemic and all of that. Okay, you do that.
Exactly.
And then what? What do these Oromo people return to, though?
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is why it just shows how, again, they're just trapped from all sides. The fact that they are even willing to go back.
Exactly.
It shows the level of the severity of what they're going through on this really horrific journey.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, right now people are physically trapped in Yemen because, like you said, this repatriation program was shut down by the Ethiopian government, blaming the pandemic, and the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia is also closed due to the pandemic. So refugees who are currently in Yemen are physically stuck in Yemen. They cannot go anywhere else, and they are stuck in a war zone. They're stuck in a war zone, and they are absolutely destitute in those circumstances. And that's why it's so important that we do what we can to help. Mm. And there is a fundraiser that can be donated to provide support for Oromo refugees in Yemen. It's on GoFundMe, Disaster Relief for Oromo Refugees in Yemen. Look that up on GoFundMe and donate to that fundraiser to help provide some support for these people who are trapped in every single sense of the word. It's such an incredibly challenging predicament for a huge number of our people. So it's really important that we do what we can to help. There is also a press conference that will have taken place by the time this episode is released. It's taking place on Tuesday, the 16th of March, in collaboration with the human rights organizations in Yemen, from Yemen, to highlight this incident that's taken place and the crisis that Oromo refugees are going through. Another aspect of that, raising awareness through that press conference, is that there will also be a Twitter campaign alongside. There will be tweets available on the OromoProtest.org website. So when you hear this, please do go to the OromoProtest.org website and share the tweets about the crisis in Yemen for Oromo refugees as well, to try and raise as much awareness as possible and get the necessary attention onto this issue.
You know what? It just made me think, probably one thing that we didn't talk much about, but it's worth mentioning, and is about internally displaced people. So people who are forced or obligated to flee their home, in particular as a result or in order to avoid the effects of an armed conflict or generalized violence. So they are still in their, you know, country of origin, but they are internally displaced and are having to leave their home and go somewhere else. And we know that for a lot of Oromo people, that is very, very common experience. So I know we've spoken today a bit about the refugee experience, the experience of people seeking asylum in the second country. And then even, like, you know, we've touched on what the settlement experience is once you are recognized as a refugee, but also, like, another area that our community is also having to deal with is internally displaced people who are still experiencing the violence and threats to their lives while still being in Oromia or in other parts of Ethiopia as well. So yeah, it is challenging on many, many, many different fronts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Completely right, Jalurga. So other things that people can do as well is to write letters to your representatives in your respective countries and in your respective regions or areas or districts, highlighting the crisis that's currently going on in Yemen alongside the rest of the issues that are being faced by Oromo people at home and abroad. And there are also protests being organized in different parts of the world. Get in touch with your local communities to find out what protests are being organized, or get in touch with your local communities to organize protests if the planning stages aren't already underway, and get involved in that way as well. But if you're in North America and Australia in particular, keep an eye out. There are protests being organized to address this particular issue. So on that note, I'd like to announce our Sabonuma Award of the Week, which is in fact another Sabontu of the Week, in honor of it being Women's History Month. We are awarding our Sabonuma Awards of the Week to women throughout the entirety of the month. And this week's Sabontu is Maseret Daba. She is an OMN journalist who is currently imprisoned by the Ethiopian regime. She's been imprisoned since the 10th of February with no charges raised against her as of just a few days ago. And she was previously arrested in January in connection with the Oromo Yellow Movement. She was one of the almost 100 people who were arrested for wearing yellow in solidarity with Oromo political prisoners. And she was released. Those charges were dismissed. But she has now been rearrested and continues to be kept in prison. So she's an outspoken advocate for Oromo people and for the Oromo plight, is facing persecution because of it, like so many others of our people. So we would like to honor her contribution to the struggle, honor her bravery, and honor her continued adherence to her principles, and for standing up for the Oromo people when it is the most difficult to do so. So that's our Sabontu of the Week.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, if I recall correctly, she was also arrested during the previous regime as well, I believe in 2016. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, we're seeing the same cycle perpetuate itself, and Oromo women throughout it all have been sacrificing and have been targeted. And shout out to her for sticking with it despite everything, because she obviously knows what's at risk. She obviously knows what could happen to her. And she's still been out there trying to share the truth. Mm-hmm. And I really admire that so much. These people, especially those who have been repeatedly arrested and imprisoned, yeah, and know what that's like. You would think that they would avoid anything to, or do anything to avoid going through that again. But for some people, the truth is what matters. And obviously, Masaret Daba is one of those people. So,
yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Most certainly. So, as usual, our listeners, we want to hear from you. We'd love for you to call us, and leave us a message. Tell us what you think about our conversation today. Tell us what you think about any of our conversations. Tell us what you think about our podcast in general. Be nice or don't. tell us whatever you want, whatever is in your mind, in your heart,
and ideas, on your chest. Including ideas.
Yes, please. Ideas, thoughts, feelings, the lot. We want all of it. So you can contact us on our number. It's +1 if you are calling or messaging from outside the US. And then it's 430-755-0727. And of course, you can reach us on our social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Team Free Oromia. So that's it for
by the way, can I just say, Jal Ango, if you live in Britain or outside of the outside of North America or the US, you don't need a calling card. You can simply follow Team Free Oromia on all the social media and you can contact them directly through that. I was the one that started the calling card thing. So for people who've been listening for previous episodes, that was me.
Oh yeah, we did mention that, didn't we?
Yeah, that was because of me, you guys. That came up because of me, because I was harassing Jal Ango.
Jal Lelise has been buying calling cards in bulk. She's been buying calling cards in bulk and mailing it out to all her friends.
I added you guys on WhatsApp and you guys weren't there. And I was like, oh, it's gonna work. So I need a calling card. Let me call Jal Ango. Let me text her. Let me get clarification. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do accept voice notes on our Instagram DMs, so there's a good option or alternative as well if you want to send us, you know, a voice message.
Absolutely. So yes, thank you very much for that additional information, Jalla Lise, it's much appreciated. Thank you so much for being here with us today, for being so candid, so open, so vulnerable, for sharing your personal experiences, and for helping us to understand more about the refugee experience from a personal perspective, from an immediate perspective. You know, we really, really, really appreciate you being here and doing that and sharing with us. So thank you immensely. We're extremely grateful. And thank you so much, Jal Uruga, as well, for providing a professional lens on many of the issues faced by Oromo refugees and also refugees in general. It's been really, really insightful to hear your perspective on this as well. So thank you so much to both of you. You're a treasure. Honestly.
Oh, thank you. And obviously thank you to our co-hosts, Jal Ango and Jal Maro. Like Team Free Oromia. Like, we absolutely adore this podcast and yeah, thank you for all the amazing work that you do and all of the things that you do behind the scenes as well. So we appreciate you guys.
Thank you.
Yes, thank definitely, you. Jal Urga. Thank you so much for all of you. And it has been my absolute pleasure to share my experience. my experience. Again, I want to reiterate that it's a very narrow experience considering what the Oromo people are now dealing with, especially in Yemen. But I am so glad that I'm able to join you guys and share what I went through and also what we need to do to help people in Yemen at the moment. So thank you so much for all your work individually and collectively.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you both thank so you much.
Ladies. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. And
you take care.
We'll catch up with our listeners again next week.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Bye, everyone.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye. I'll be listening.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Nahi mi makaxe na ya tchese se fundo fabonto nagama tchese halkanu kalkala najala tchese tanjolu masan nadaba tchese oromia.